So Jacob is one of the patriarchs. And to be honest, as we look at this guy's life story, it does sound a bit crackers. I mean, it really does live up to the light crispy snack. It's one of those stories that sounds so sort of fantastical in many ways. And yet I think it can have quite a surprisingly relevant and modern feel to it, particularly when it comes to the dysfunction that each one of us have because we have been raised in a family. Let's start with the birth. I found this picture, which I thought was absolutely horrific. I couldn't resist putting it in. So for a start, we've got Isaac's wife, Rebecca. She is about to give birth to twin boys. But even before that, in a sort of weird, slightly Games of Thrones-esque way, these two babies are warring within her womb to the extent that the Lord actually gives her a sort of a prophecy and tells her that your two sons are going to be rivals. They're going to war against each other, and they're both going to birth a nation each. One will be stronger than the other, but the younger will rule over the older. So Esau's born first, and he's born with a sort of red coat of body hair. I don't know, think orangutan. And his name actually means hairy. So, you know, this one's hairy. And then as Jacob is born, he is grasping his brother's heel as he comes out. So like he's like, no, I want to be first, but not quite. And so he is called Jacob, which does not mean crackers. It means supplanter. So in a book of names, really, would you call this one Harry and this one supplanter? I mean, it's not something that we would tend to think of, although there are many people out there these days called Jacob. For some reason, Esau hasn't caught on so much. So these two brothers are born, and they're born as rivals. In fact, we learn that Esau, he's the apple of his father's eye. He likes hunting and fishing. And he's an outdoors kind of man, just like his father. He smells of the woods. He smells of good, honest labor. He smells. And then we've got Jacob. And Jacob, he's quieter. He likes to stay at home. It would appear he's quite good at cooking. And he's a bit more of his mum's favorite. So he's a little bit more of a mother's boy, if you like. So right from the start, we've got two parents who are both rooting for their own sort of favorite son. Why is that important? Well, here are a few glimpses, a few postcards into this family dysfunction. One day, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau arrived home from the wilderness, exhausted and hungry. Esau said to Jacob, "I'm starved. Give me some of that red lentil stew." And this is apparently how Esau got his name Edom, which means red. "All right," Jacob replied, "but trade me your rights as the firstborn son." I mean, it's an obvious one, isn't it? Lentil stew, rights of firstborn son. So it's a strange story for us already because we're not from that sort of Middle Eastern culture. And to be honest, we probably don't value this sense of birthright and birth order in the way that they did then. "Look, I'm dying of starvation," said Esau. "What good is my birthright to me now?" So Jacob said, "So first you must swear that your birthright is mine." So Esau swore an oath, thereby selling all his rights as a firstborn to his brother Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. Esau ate the meal, then got up and left. He showed contempt for his rights as a firstborn. Now, what is the big deal? I mean, I am a firstborn. Here are me and my sisters. So it's me, and then it's Helen, who's the one on the other side, and then Shiona, the one in the middle. So that's the order with us. And I don't really think there's much in the whole birth order thing, at least at first glance. I mean, for sure, Shiona, as the youngest, got away with murder, things that we would never be allowed to do. She stayed up later. She just got away with everything. How is it with you? Are you number one? Are you number two? How many brothers and sisters do you have? Where do you fit in? And would you say that birth order has made any difference in the way that each of you have been raised or in the way that each of you would tend to treat your siblings? What's the dynamic? I'm just going to give you literally just 2 minutes. So just just in pairs, turn to someone next to you and just have a quick conversation about that. So according to psychologists, parents generally have decided on the label for their child by the time they're four. That's how early on a parent has started to say, well, yeah, our child is the sporty one, or the clever one, the loud one, the shy one, the needy one, the promising one, the not so promising one, the troublesome one, and work your way through the seven dwarves, you know, the sneezy one, whatever, I don't know, the grumpy one. All parents do it. It's really, really hard not to. And often what happens is that whatever label has been fulfilled by the first one, the second kid kind of, I've got to have my own label. So typically they talk about a first child tends to be more responsible, bossy. The third parent to the other kids, telling them what to do, they're often the rule abider. The second child tends to be like the rock star. They're the ones who've learned being good does not get me attention, but hey, being bad, now then I get attention, and that's what they go for. I mean, these are broad stereotypes, but there's truth in them. They say that if you're one of four, often the third child is the one that feels like the one that's left out, because the first two kids, you know, they get on together, and so the third child's desperate to hang out with the cool older ones. And has experienced, you know, being the cute youngest one and then got supplanted by someone cuter and younger. They don't want to play with them. They want to play with the older kids. And so often it's the third child who feels, well, like, I don't know where I fit in. And then the fourth child, obviously you can keep going, but we'll stick with four. Then the fourth child, typically, or the youngest child, typically is more laid back. They're usually the harmonizer. They try and keep everyone happy. They're often more indecisive as a result because they're not used to making decisions, because when were they ever asked? And as I said before, they get away with murder. So there can be a little bit more to it, can't there? This whole order business. But also, as I've said before, the problem with labels is they're really hard to get off. And sometimes they might be applicable when you're two. Oh yeah, this is the poopy one. This is the vomity one. When you're 20, hopefully, that label need not apply. And yet so often, we find that we're still living under labels that we've been given. So let's carry on looking at this. We've got Jacob. He's like he's the jock. Possibly a bit thick, brawny, strong. He's like your man's man. So where does that leave Jacob, the youngest son? Well, he figures out, like, I've got to be the sneaky one, which is my name, actually, supplanter. So here's what happens. Jacob's mother overhears Isaac, her husband, who's now blind, overhears that he tells Esau, go out and catch some game for me. You know, go and fire your arrows at some goats, bring them back and make my favorite stew, and then I will give you my blessing. Because Isaac is at a point now, the father is at a point where he knows that he's going to die soon. And he wants to pass on his blessing before he does. And again, this idea of firstborn rights and blessing, there's something very, very strong in that ancient Middle Eastern culture that passes us by in some respects. So here's the story. So Jacob went out. So what happens is Esau goes off like, all right, Dad, I'll go hunting and I'll come back. I'll cook you your favorite stew and then you can bless me. It's great. So he goes off, but his mum hears what's going on and she figures out, I want my team. I'm on team Jacob and I want him to get the blessing. So she says, she comes up with a plan. She says, we're going to fake it. You are going to be your brother. Now, there's a famous passage that says, kind of, the problem with this, because Esau was a hairy man and Jacob was a smooth man. So quite how they were going to, you know, deal with this whole thing, especially in a sort of pre-Gillette age, was unclear. So let's find out what happened. So Jacob went out and got the young goats for his mother, Rebecca, and prepared a delicious meal just the way, sorry, and gave them to his mother, who prepared a delicious meal just the way that Isaac liked it. Then she took Esau's favorite clothes, which were there in the house, and gave them to her younger son Jacob. She covered his arms and the smooth parts of his neck with the skin of the young goats. Then she gave Jacob the delicious meal, including freshly baked bread. So Jacob took the food to his father. "My father," he said. "Yes, my son," Isaac answered. "Who are you, Esau or Jacob?" Bear in mind, the guy's blind, right? Jacob replied, "It's Esau, your firstborn son. I've done as you told me. Here is a wild game. Now sit up and eat it so you can give me your blessing." Isaac asked, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" "Oh, ha, ha, the Lord your God put it in my path," Jacob replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come closer so I can touch you and make sure that you really are Esau." So Jacob went closer to his brother, and Isaac touched him. The voice is Jacob's, but the hands, but they're practically furry. They're definitely Esau's, Isaac said. But he did not recognize Jacob because Jacob's hands felt hairy, just like Esau's. So Isaac prepared to bless Jacob. "But are you really my son, Esau?" he replied. "Yes, I am," Jacob replied. Then Isaac said, "Now, my son, bring me the wild game. Let me eat it, and then I will give you my blessing." So Jacob took the food to his father, and Isaac ate it. He also drank the wine that Jacob served him. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come a little closer and kiss me, my son." So Jacob went over and kissed him. And when Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, he was finally convinced, and he blessed his son. He said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of the outdoors, which the Lord has blessed. From the dew of heaven and the richness of the earth, may God always give you abundant harvests of grain and bountiful new wine. May many nations become your servants, and may they bow down before you. May you be the master over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. All who curse you will be cursed, and all who bless you will be blessed." As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and almost before Jacob had left his father, Esau returned from his hunt. Esau prepared a delicious meal and brought it to his father. Then he said, "Sit up, my father, and eat my wild game, so you can give me your blessing." But Isaac asked him, "Who are you?" Esau replied, "It's your son, your firstborn son, Esau." Isaac began to tremble uncontrollably and said, "Then who just served me wild game? I've already eaten it, and I blessed him just before you came, and yes, that blessing must stand." When Esau heard his father's words, he let out a loud and bitter cry. "Oh, my father, what about me? Bless me too," he begged. But Isaac said, "Your brother was here, and he tricked me. He has taken away your blessing." Then Esau said, "No wonder his name is Jacob, for now he's cheated me twice. First he took my rights as a firstborn, and now he's stolen my blessing. Oh, haven't you even saved one blessing for me?" And Isaac said to Esau, "I have made Jacob your master and have declared that all his brothers will be his servants. I have guaranteed him an abundance of grain and wine. What is left for me to give you, my son?" And Esau pleaded, "But do you have only one blessing? Oh, my father, bless me too." And then Esau broke down and wept. Finally, his father, Isaac, said to him, "You will live away from the richness of the earth and away from the dew of the heaven above. You will live by the sword and you will serve your brother. But when you decide to break free, you will shake his yoke from your neck." From that time on, Esau hated Jacob because their father had given Jacob the blessing. And Esau began to scheme, "I will soon be mourning my father's death, and then I will kill my brother, Jacob." Like I said, it can feel a little bit like, "Oh, Grandma, what big eyes you have." You know, I mean, it's got elements of sort of fairy tale. But actually, what's it feel like when you're the one who didn't make it? I remember talking to this incredible woman in Hyderabad in India. I was part of a leadership course there, and she was one of the leaders there. She was developing curriculums for Dalit schools for the entire country of India. So Dalit is the term today that we thankfully use instead of the horrible term untouchable. So people who are Dalit caste, they are the lowest caste. Traditionally, they're only allowed to buy tea or coffee in little clay cups so that those cups can be smashed afterwards, lest someone from a higher caste drink from them by mistake and be sullied by having drunk from an untouchable. It's nasty. And today, Dalits all over India are saying, actually, why do we want to be Hindus? Like, this is such a rubbish religion that treats us like absolute dirt. And many of them are converting to other religions, and many of them are becoming Christians. So here was this woman who was, her name was Rubella, which is a disease. But her father liked the sound of it, because it does sound nice. And so here was this woman who had developed a curriculum for these schools that are being set up to empower and educate a new generation of Dalit kids who are going to rise up beyond the prejudice that they've grown up with and hopefully start a new future. And I just wanted to understand her better because she was one of the most passionate teachers I've ever met. So I asked her if she could tell me her story. And she did. She said, "So, my parents were cursed with six girls. Now, if you know anything about India, they have the dowry system. I kind of get the dowry system in the Middle East or in Central Asia where I used to live, which is that I'll buy your daughter for however much the price is, and then she will like work her fingers to the bone for me." Forever onwards. That I can kind of get my head around. But in India, it's I will pay you a huge amount of money to take my daughter and then she'll work her fingers to the bone for you and your family for the rest of her life. It's really weird, to me at least. But that's the dowry system. So already her father was like, how am I ever going to pay dowries for all my girls? And anyway, he ended up being put in prison and for murder. I don't know whether or not he committed murder. And so her mum had to make the decision, who am I going to keep and who am I not going to keep? And Rubella didn't make the grade. She got sent off to an orphanage. And she was telling me, at first, it was just hard. I mean, there was maybe 25 kids for every adult. So I felt pretty invisible. But then they had to make cuts in the orphanage. And then there was just one adult for every 100 kids. And nobody knew who I was. No one cared for me. And when we go to school, we were like, oh, yeah, you're the reject kids. They knew that we weren't orphans. They knew that most of us had parents. They also knew that our parents thought we weren't worth loving and weren't worth keeping. In the end, there was a teacher at her school who said to her one day, Rubella, I want you to stay behind after class. So she thought, okay. And the teacher said to her, listen, I don't know if you realize this, but you have real talent. I think that you could become an English teacher one day, like me. And that's what I would love to see you become. And just having one person who believed in her kind of led her on this journey to today. She's now writing curriculum, which is incredible. But the point being that it's really hard to be the one who didn't make it, who didn't make the cut. We see it in nature as well. Every litter has got a runt, the one that didn't quite make it, the one that wasn't pushy enough and get the milk. And there are even some species of bird where they will have two chicks and yet only one of them will survive. And that's kind of built into the system, if you like, an idea of making sure that only the strongest survives. It's really horrible. What's the impact of sibling rivalry and parental favoritism, these two themes that we see here? What's the impact of that on a family, on a person? I'm really lucky because I think me and my sisters, we didn't have much sibling. I didn't have much sibling rivalry with them, and that's partly because they're not boys. Now, if I'd had a brother, I don't know. I don't know what it might have been like, an older brother, younger brother. What I do know is that we used to play family games in Monopoly. And there was a general pattern, which was my mum was first to go out. I think that was deliberate on her part, to be honest. It's like, yeah, here, you can have Park Lane. Give me Old Kent Road, or whatever it might be. And gradually it would whittle down, and it would always end up being me and Helen, the next one down. It's still too soon. But she would always win. But that wasn't victory. Winning was just part of it. It was only victory when she'd managed to push my buttons enough so that I would storm out of the room and slam the door behind her. And then she was like, now I've won. I used to live in Uzbekistan, and I lived with a local family. I lived with them for 7 years, and I watched, I was part of that family, and I watched how my Uzbek dad, who I loved, I watched him, how he raised his two sons. One of them could do nothing wrong, and the other one could do nothing right. And it really broke my heart, because I was there, and I had that whole, you know, what right have I got to say anything or intervene? And it was so unfair. And I thought, you know, am I the only one that sees this? I was in Belgium last year, or the year before actually, and got jamming with two of the students who were there on this mission week. And one of them, she was playing the keys, and she just had the most incredible voice. And I said to her at one point, I was like, are you aware of just how amazing your voice is? And like, I love how you harmonize. And the first thing she said to me was, oh, well, you should hear my sister. My sister has an EP. And it was really weird, because there was this shadow of her sister that I couldn't see. But it was a shadow that she clearly was carrying around with her. Like, she can never be good because her sister would always be better. What's it like to live in the shadow of someone, an older brother or an older sister, sometimes even a younger, brilliant brother or a younger sister? You know, when you hear your parents bragging about the other one, oh yes, and then Tarquin here, he managed to get into Oxford, and you're like, oh, okay, well, I thought it was pretty good that I got into Warwick, or whatever it might be. It's really hard. Comparisons are horrible. I remember we had some family friends, and their eldest son was really, really hot. I mean, this guy was so good looking, like sickening. And he was in the under-18s rugby for Scotland. And he was nice. And his younger brother was one of my good friends. And he hadn't, the whole genetic thing, it just hadn't worked out for him in such a good way. And he was lovely. And the whole rugby thing, it wasn't his thing. And then his older brother died tragically in a car accident. And I thought, how do you compete with a perfect dead older brother? Like, that, you're going to have that. Like, he's always going to be that age, the golden boy. He's always going to be there. And you're going to grow up. Like, how do you do that? And I kind of felt a double heartbreak for him. Like, you've lost your brother, but also, like, that shadow is permanently imprinted there. One thing I want to say about comparison is that it really only has three results. One of them is pride. Another of them is jealousy. And a third is insecurity. I'll say that again. I think comparison has three results. Pride, insecurity, and jealousy. Yay! What great options. How is it when your parents raise you differently because of your gender? When there's one rule for the boys and there's another rule for the girls? That doesn't happen quite so much in this culture, but it happens a lot in other cultures. It used to really sadden me again when I lived in Central Asia and would watch the parenting styles. Like, little boys could run around naked and that was absolutely fine, and they would go off swimming in the canals in the summer and that was fine. Little girls, they were taught shame, shame. You've got to put clothes on. Here, take a broom, go and sweep. The first thing that you say if you find out that your friends have had a firstborn girl is, no, it's really good because, you know, she can help raise the other kids. That's a consolation. You see, a boy is valued for who he is and a girl is valued for what she can do. Did your mum and dad have a favourite? How did that make you feel? How did you feel about the whole fairness side? Maybe you had a mum who had a favourite and a dad who had a different favourite. Even if you know it's unfair, it can become normal. Most families think that they're normal, but is there really such a thing? It's a bit like the air that we breathe around us every day. We're not necessarily even conscious of it. I remember visiting my sister Helen when she lived in Shepherd's Bush, and it was winter, it was cold, and I remember coming into the house and blowing my nose and looking down at this kind of black stuff on the tissue, and I was just like, oh, I've got nasal cancer. And she's like, no, mate, you've got London bogies. I was like, what? Is that a thing? She's like, yeah, it's polluted around here. It's normal. People get black bogies. That's the air you're breathing. And I kind of knew I was in central London, but I hadn't fully realized the effect that this air was having on me, internally, on my lungs, on my ability to breathe, and my ability to use my body fully. And I think that the effects of favoritism and some of these other things can be far more damaging than London bogies. Let's go back to the theme of the patriarchs. So we've been looking at the patriarchs. We've looked at Abraham, Isaac. Today we're looking at Jacob. Then we'll be looking at Joseph as well. So we've got, first of all, spousal manipulation. Let's start with Abraham. So with Abraham, we've got Sarah, or Sarai, who hears that God has promised Abraham that he's going to be a father of many. So she's like, well, let's sort this out then. You know, let's game the system. Here, sleep with my servant girl, and then you'll get pregnant because I'm too old. So sleep with her, and then we'll be able to have the kid. You know, then we can make it all work. So you see this theme of spousal manipulation. Then you go down to Isaac, and you see the same thing happen with his wife. His wife's like, no, my favorite son's going to get the blessing. And here's how we're going to do it. Like, we're going to do this whole, you know, sticking the bits of goat on your arms thing. And then we go down to Jacob. Now, Jacob has a whole load of sons. And who's the golden boy? Who's the golden boy that gets given, here's a little clue, a special, very beautiful robe of many colors? Joseph. Do you see what I'm talking about? It's family dysfunction being passed from generation to generation to generation. Again, parental favoritism. So we've got Ishmael born. Now, he's not born to the wife. He's born to the servant girl, Abraham's servant girl. And eventually, because Sarah gets jealous, even though it's entirely her own fault that her servant girl now has a kid, he gets sent out. The mother and son get sent off to the desert to die. God has mercy on them. But there you've got the favorite son, Isaac. Then you've got the other one. Then we get down to the favorite son, Esau, and then the other one who ends up tricking and getting the blessing. Then you go down again to Joseph, the favorite. And what's the result of that? Well, we hear that Ishmael and Isaac are going to be fathers of nation. And according to tradition, actually, Ishmael is the descendants of Ishmael who become the Arabs and then who become the Muslims. And in fact, if you read the Quran, it's Ishmael who gets the blessing and who gets taken off to almost be sacrificed. Then we go down to our story now with Jacob and Esau, and we see again sibling hatred. Then we go down to Joseph and his brothers, and what do? Do they all say, yay, Dad, we love the fact that you've given our brother a beautiful fancy coat. Isn't that nice? Let's all just applaud him. No, they decide that they're going to tear that coat up, they're going to drop him down a well, leave him there to die, and then they're going to dip it in the blood of a goat and show it to Jacob and say, oh, Dad, it's really sad, but, like, you know, lions, wolves, something, you know, he's dead. And in the end, the only reason they don't kill him is because they see a passing caravan they sell their brother as a slave. So we get this continual passing down of dysfunction, this continual passing down of sin. I wonder, what are the themes in your family? Have you ever done something like a spiritual genogram? What they are is it's a family tree. You look at your grandparents, then you look at your parents and their siblings on both sides, and then you look at your brothers and sisters. And you look at some of the themes that are there. They can include divorce, cutting off where people are no longer talking to each other. They can include lies. That can be quite a theme sometimes. Secrets can be another one. Enmeshment, So, for example, well, okay, so she's married to him, but basically, like, no one cut the umbilical cord. Like, she, you know, the mum's involved in that relationship too much, or whatever it might be. It can include abuse, verbal, physical, sexual. I wonder what the words are that your families live by. I think of two people who I've mentored. One of them, he said, there's an unspoken family motto that we have, which is never talk about the elephant in the room. We are all nice in my family. Everything's nice. Everything's okay. And we never, like, the carpets in our house are so rucked because there's so much stuff that we've swept underneath. We never talk about it. You know, we quietly peer around elephants. Lovely weather we're having today, isn't it? That was one family. Another guy, he said, my family motto would be never show weakness. Weakness is like blood in the water. They can smell it. As soon as you show vulnerability or weakness, they'll be on you. Here are some examples of family commandments that we can live by. Money. Money is the best source of security. The more money you have, the more important you are. Make lots of money to prove that you've made it. Some families will have this with conflict. Avoid conflict at all costs. Everything needs to be nice. Or don't get people mad at you. Loud, angry, constant fighting is normal. Sex. Sex is not spoken about openly in our family. Or men can be promiscuous, but women, well, they need to be chaste. Sexuality within marriage will come easily. Grief and loss. Sadness is a sign of weakness. You're not allowed to be depressed. Get over losses quickly and move on. Expressing anger. Anger is dangerous and bad. Explode in anger to make your point. Sarcasm is an acceptable way to release anger. Family. You owe your parents for all they've done for you. Don't speak of your family's dirty laundry in public. Duty to family and culture comes before everything else. Relationships. Don't trust people. They'll only let you down. Nobody will ever hurt me again. Don't show vulnerability. When it comes to listening, listen to defend, rebut, or appease. You have nothing important to say. Hear the words, but ignore the nonverbal signals. Success. Success is getting into the best schools. Success is making lots of money. Success is having kids, getting married, and having a family of your own. Feelings and emotions. You're not allowed to have certain feelings. Your feelings are not important. Reacting with your feelings without thinking is okay. Those are just a few. It can feel quite depressing, can't it? Often we tend to think of the Old Testament patriarchs as, aren't these meant to be kind of examples for us to live by? I want to say they can be examples to us, but like, let's not follow everything that they're modeling. And here's the good news. The good news is that Jesus can break the chains. But it really helps to know what those chains are first. I think we have two weapons at our disposal. I think forgiveness and repentance. Sometimes it's not until we kind of metaphorically blow our nose and realize, man, have I been living in central London? That is black. And we're like, oh, actually, I didn't realize the air that I've been breathing, what an impact it's had on me. I wonder what some of the things are that you would like to see broken in your family. Are there shadows of siblings you've been living under? Were you jealous of the favorite, the golden child? Or did you feel guilt because you were the favorite? Did your parents used to always compare you? We need to have grace because every single parent will make mistakes. But at the same time, we also need to see the chains that have been passed down from generation to generation. We need to see them broken. A friend of mine at Wycliffe College, where I studied, he told me about how he had grown up with an incredible dysfunctional mum who would have a string of abusive boyfriends who used to abuse him physically. I'm not sure in any other way. Many of living in a council estate. Eventually, he managed to run away from home and actually asked to be taken into care, and got taken in by a Christian family and came to faith. And when I see him now as a parent, I see broken chains. When I see the way that he is treating his children, it makes, you know, it makes me feel really emotional because what has been passed down has been broken, and it can be broken. So practically, what are some things you can do? If anything here has resonated with you tonight, if you're aware of some of these things, like, I need to work this through. We've got the Keys to Freedom course starting after Easter. And this is a course specifically aimed to help you work through baggage from the past. It's a really safe place to work in community with a small group of other trusted people, and it can be life-changing. I also think if you don't have a mentor already, find a mentor. And if you want to find one, speak to Luke, speak to me, and we can help you find one. If you feel like, actually, I'd really like to work through some of this. So that's another thing that you can do. But I also want to say that if anything has hit a nerve tonight, how about take that first step and get some prayer? And all of us have had some experience of family, and all families fail in some way, and all of us have baggage. This is not something that we should feel any sense of shame about. It's particularly weird when we feel shame about stuff. Like, did any of you kind of sign up to your family? I didn't. I mean, I love them, but I didn't, like, tick any boxes. That's just where I was born. It's something we can't control. But God can break chains. His Holy Spirit can change things. And curses and dysfunction that has been passed down can stop. And it can stop tonight.